You can turn your great idea into a reality, whatever reality means to you, with Squarespace. Squarespace makes it easier than ever to launch your passion project, whether you're showcasing your work or selling products of any kind. With beautiful templates and the ability to customize just about everything, you can easily make a beautiful website yourself. And if you do get stuck, Squarespace's 24/7 award-winning customer support is there to help. Check out squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use the offer code SOSMART to save 10% off of your first purchase of a website or a domain. That's squarespace.com, and the offer code is SOSMART for 10% off. Welcome to the You Are Not So Smart podcast, episode 130.
My grandfather, he's a retired dentist. He is currently 99 years old. And so back in dental school, which I guess was in the 30s, I believe, he learned the wrong number of human chromosomes.
This is complexity scientist Sam Arbisman.
My name is Sam Arbisman, and I'm a scientist in residence at Lux Capital, a venture capital firm.
Sam's current work involves connecting startups with scientists who they might not know could help them advance the goals of their fledgling companies.
And so really, my whole job is really just like this kind of import-export business of knowledge, which is pretty cool.
Sam's background is in computational biology, and he earned his doctorate studying how to create mathematical models that could help scientists better understand how complex systems interact, things like networks and cells and stuff like that. So basically, Sam studies knowledge itself, which is why he likes telling this story about his grandfather.
He learned that there were 48 chromosomes within a human cell. This was, I think, like in the textbooks at the time, as far as I know. And it turned out it was because, I guess in the 1950s, someone actually created a better imaging technique and recounted and realized, wait a second, there's actually only 46.
For decades, if you trained to be a doctor of any kind, or if you worked in any biological science, or if you had a textbook that mentioned chromosomes, this basic fact concerning the number of chromosomes was, well, it was wrong.
And it was taught to students, not just kind of, it wasn't sort of some bit of esoteric knowledge that was only imparted to kind of people working at the frontier of knowledge. I mean, it was taught to medical students and dental students. And my grandfather learned the wrong number, which is kind of wild.
This might surprise you. It surprised me. But Sam told me that it's pretty common for medical students at the beginning of their schooling to be told, half of what you are about to learn will not be true by the time you graduate. We just don't know which half.
And this is taught, and I think even now, there's this idea, that, and I think within medicine, medicine seems to be one of the areas that has most well kind of imbibed this idea that things are going to be changing constantly, and you have to be always aware of this fact.
In fact, Sam wrote a book about this fact called The Half-Life of Facts. And the premise of this book is that for every domain, every silo and discipline and school of knowledge, the facts contained within are slowly being overturned and augmented and replaced. And in medicine, for example, the rate of that overturning is so high that you never really complete your education. Medical school, in other words, never ends.
When lives are on the line, you better have the most up-to-date knowledge. You better know the best technique. You better know the the most accurate information about the human body, because otherwise you could make a wrong decision. And so I think this idea that the teachers within medical school are constantly like just letting their students know that things are going to be overturned is like remarkably refreshing, as opposed to what we might see in other areas where you say, okay, here is the truth, and then you kind of just get blindsided by things that you thought were accurate and that are actually now being overturned.
My name is David McCraney. This is the You're Not So Smart podcast. And in this episode, we are exploring this idea with Sam, this notion that science is a self-correcting system. So it not only continuously adds new evidence, making it so that there are things we know today that we didn't know yesterday, but it never stops attacking the ideas that it already has. It never stops tearing down its own models. So a lot of what we knew yesterday, what we considered factual, well, it isn't true anymore. Sam says these two processes create churn. They create this overturning process that's consistent, but it's also unique from one silo to the next. So, for instance, in physics, about half of all the research findings will be disconfirmed within 13 years. In psychology, it's every 7. Some facts withstand the test of time, and a whole lot do not. So to paraphrase computer scientist Nils Nilsson and historian James Burke, our explanations and our models of reality, they can only be constructed from the materials at hand, from the facts that are in our current collection and the beliefs those facts support. So when the facts change, and they will, so will our models, explanations, and beliefs. So knowing that, what does this tell us about how to approach the truth and rationality and how to live our lives and stay healthy and who to trust and all the rest? Well, we'll get to that after this commercial break. Hiring can be challenging, but not with ZipRecruiter. If you're looking for an easy way to connect to qualified candidates, go to ZipRecruiter.com/not-so-smart. ZipRecruiter finds the right candidates for you. When you post your job, ZipRecruiter sends it to more than 100 of the web's leading job boards. And with their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. And ZipRecruiter analyzes applications as they come in. They put a spotlight on the top candidates so you never miss a great catch. And ZipRecruiter is so effective that 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. Now, with results like that, it's no wonder that ZipRecruiter is the highest-rated hiring site in America. And right now, listeners to this show can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/not-so-smart. Let's say that again so you never forget it. ZipRecruiter.com/N-O-T-S-O-S-M-A-R-T. That's ZipRecruiter.com/not-so-smart. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. I love digging into the topics that fascinate me. I like to get a better understanding of, well, you know, anything, and discovering something new is the best thing ever. And that's why I love the Great Courses Plus. That's what I do with it. I love it. You will love it too. If you love this show, I know you will love the Great Courses Plus. It's an unlimited pass to explore everything about anything, learning from leading professors and experts in their fields, streaming thousands of lectures in pretty much every topic that's ever been: psychology, history, mathematics, even how to cook better, how to take great photographs, how to play the guitar, how to play chess. You will learn all this with the Great Courses Plus. And with the Great Courses Plus app, you get total access to watch or listen to anything you want completely on your schedule. One course that I've enjoyed, and I think that you will enjoy, is Argumentation, the Study of Effective Reasoning. This is a great course if you liked any of the logical fallacy episodes, because that's all this is about. It's about effective argumentation. It takes Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt and all the other great figures who were masters of the craft and says, what's rhetoric? You get 24 lectures, 30 minutes each, the complex structures of an argument. the history of argumentation studies, attacking and defending, language and style and argument, evaluating evidence, hybrid patterns of inference. What does that mean? You will find out. Arguments between friends, arguments among experts, public argumentation in democratic life. All of these lectures you can watch or listen to, and here's the best thing, for free. I know you're going to love The Great Courses Plus, and so I've arranged for a special limited time offer just for listeners of this show. You get a month for free. You can listen to or watch Argumentation, the Study of Effective Reasoning, or anything else that you can get into your brain in a month for free. But to get this month, you have to go to this URL. Here it is. Sign up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/smart. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/smart. And now we return to our program. My name is David McCraney, and this is the You Are Not So Smart podcast. The term half-life in physics, to put it way, way too simply, is how long it takes for half of the atoms in a chunk of a specific radioactive material to decay. The time it takes for one atom of, say, plutonium to do this is random and unpredictable, but the time it takes for a cluster of plutonium atoms to decay is constant, and it is predictable. The randomness of all the atoms together averages out. So the time it takes for exactly half of the atoms in a chunk of plutonium to decay is called its half-life. According to scientist and author Sam Arbesman, bodies of knowledge like forestry or accounting or anthropology also have half-lives, an amount of time it takes for half of what is considered true in those bodies of knowledge to be overturned as new evidence is uncovered and old evidence is scrutinized.
I might not necessarily be able to predict what new scientific discovery is going to occur or what fact is going to be overturned in the next scientific paper, but overall, there is a shape to how knowledge grows, changes, spreads from person to person, and even becomes overturned over time. And that is sort of the idea of the half-life of knowledge. And it turns out that people have actually tried to take that even more seriously and begun to understand how long it takes for facts within a certain body of knowledge, let's say within medicine, to become overturned or rendered obsolete. And people have actually even done some calculations to try to understand a little bit more the kinds of things that would look like half-lives for knowledge.
So here are some of these half-lives. Here are some of these rates. In physics, the half-life is 13.07 years. It's 9.38 years in economics, 9.17 years in math, and 7.15 in psychology. And Sam says in his book that the rate of change differs enough that facts can be sorted into three categories. There's the kind that are in constant flux, like the current weather conditions, or the population of the planet, or the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Then there are these things that are extremely stable. Very stable facts like how many fingers are on the average human hand, how many moons does the planet Earth have, the average length of a blue whale. In the middle are what he calls mesofacts, facts that change every few years, like how many elements are on the periodic table, what's the fastest speed that we can go, what is the height of the tallest building, what foods and activities are dangerous to your health, and so on. And it's these mesofacts that can sometimes cause people to have really strange perspectives on the advancement of knowledge. Not only are your old textbooks just snapshots of what we knew at the time they were written, the advice from your doctor is based on a snapshot of what medicine knew at the time that advice was given.
For the most part, I mean, people read, like they read the news of science and say, oh, like what I thought was nutritious is now bad for you, or vice versa. Or dinosaurs look very different than how they used to. Or now we have to take care of babies differently. They used to sleep on their stomachs, now they sleep on their backs.
Sam says that mesofacts often cause people to feel overwhelmed. And in some cases, they just tune out the churn at some point, happy to live with the facts as they were when they decided to check out and stop updating their knowledge of the world.
So I think, and certainly, I can understand that urge to like not be You don't want to be surrounded by constant change because it can be overwhelming. I think there are a number of things that actually exacerbate that feeling and make it even harder. So one of them is when we're young, we're treated almost like little generalists. We learn a ton about every different topic. Like you're in school, especially elementary school, you're learning all the different sciences, you're learning English and history and social science. Like you're learning all different things. And this persists even throughout high school. And then in college you start specializing, and then you might specialize even more if you go to graduate school. And you end up learning more and more about less and less as you go on. And so even though in your area of specialty, you're probably well adapted to realizing, oh yeah, things change and like I just kind of have to stay up to date. So let's say you're a physician, you have continuing medical education, because lives are actually at stake. And so you really want to know the best way to treat people. But if things are changing outside of your areas, you often still have the ideas from when you're in elementary school or middle school or even high school. And those are almost static. Until, of course, you're actually confronted by, let's say your kid comes home from school and says, guess what? Dinosaurs look sort of like fearsome chickens. They're not these kind of slow, plodding reptilian monsters. And you're like, what? When did all this happen? And it turns out, of course, paleontologists didn't stop working. They didn't like take this hiatus between your elementary school and your child's elementary school. They were continuously learning new things and changing, but you only perceive that change in a very kind of staccato, stepwise fashion because you're confronted by the next generation learning some new things.
Even though facts are changing at a regular pace in most silos, if it isn't in your area, if it's not in your line of work, you don't get the news usually until something big changes, like Pluto is no longer a planet, or we can now clone sheep. These seemingly sudden shifts in what is true, what is possible, are something Sam calls fact phase transitions. Other examples include going from no knowledge of exoplanets to the fact that they exist, not knowing DNA's structure to knowing it, no airplanes to the invention of the airplane, no smartphones until the unveiling of the iPhone. In each case, for most people, the shift seemed rapid and instantaneous, going from one world where one thing was or was not true to another where it was the opposite. And just like Burke and Nielsen said, who I quoted earlier, with these new facts, people must adjust their beliefs and their models of reality to accommodate. So it can really feel inside this like a phase transition, like you're going from one state of truth to the other. But underneath these changes, there's almost always a continuous process of fact overturning somewhere.
While there are these rapid changes in what we think to be true or what we know to be true. So, for example, whether or not anyone has ever walked on the moon. Up until 1969, the answer is no, no one has walked on the moon. After 1969, the answer is yes, people have walked on the moon. And so this is a very discontinuous change about the world. But it turns out there was this underlying parameter that was actually fairly smoothly changing, which in this case was the top speed that people could achieve. We could kind of go faster and faster on horses, then cars, then in airplanes, and then in spacecraft. And eventually we're going to hit a speed where we will be able to actually go to the moon. I don't remember the exact details, but I believe I think the U.S. military had graphed some of these top speed changes. And based on this kind of smooth parameter, we're actually able to fairly reasonably predict when people would land on the moon. And I believe this was done maybe in the earlier mid-50s, so like I would say over a decade before America landed on the moon.
One of the reasons that people often have misconceptions about how science works and really how knowledge accumulates and changes is the way they learn of new developments. The core of science overturns pretty slowly, and some things are almost static, like the number of continents or the way the heart pumps blood. Most of the news, though, that you get about science isn't about the incremental changes to this kind of knowledge. It's about shocking, weird, and extreme changes from the very edge of our understanding. These are often small, single studies, and as such, they'll likely be torn to pieces within a few years. And when they are, well, that will make headlines too.
When a new scientific finding occurs, that's at the frontier of science. That's where we know the least, but where the most exciting things are happening. But it also means necessarily that a lot of that stuff is going to be overturned. because that's where scientists are operating. That's where they have all their debates, and they're kind of going back and forth and really trying to understand what should be the consensus about what is going on. And for scientists, and they want to work at that frontier. It's awesome. It's really, really exciting. It's super cool to kind of see that constant churning of knowledge. But when it's portrayed in the news as, guess what, like, thing we thought was true a year ago is now been overturned, that can be a little overwhelming to people, even though, of course, the core of knowledge is not changing nearly as much. And actually, this was brought home to me when I was talking to there's a professor of mine from back in grad school. I was visiting him and speaking with him, and he gave me this great, he told me this great story where he said that he was teaching a course, and I think went in and lectured on a Tuesday about some topic, and then the next day read some paper that actually invalidated the thing he had learned that he had taught the day before. So he came in on Thursday to the class and he said, "Remember what I taught you on Tuesday? It's wrong. And if that bothers you, you need to get out of science." And he was essentially saying that, like, science is constantly in a draft form, always obviously much more at the frontier than at the core. But we need to recognize that. I'm almost a revel in that. And that if we don't have that scientific mindset, it's going to be constantly overwhelming. Now, of course, even among scientists, it's probably much more overwhelming when it's your own research that's being invalidated as opposed to someone else's, or you are invalidating someone else's research. But I think at the core, whether you're a scientist or not, this idea of kind of the scientific mode of thinking, that science is less about a body of knowledge and more about a method of querying the world, I think that's the kind of thing that people really need to internalize. Because once you internalize the fact that science is a means of querying the world and understanding it better, the individual facts, they can change, they can be overturned, and that's totally fine because it means at every stage we're learning more. And this is actually goes back to another thing I mentioned in my book, where Isaac Asimov, the science fiction writer, he was corresponding with someone, and this person was saying, we used to think the world was flat, and now we don't. Therefore, how can we know anything is true? And he's like, well, and we used to think the world was flat, and then we thought it was perfectly spherical. Now we kind of know it's like this, like, oblate spheroid. But if you think thinking the world is perfectly spherical is just as wrong as thinking the world is flat, then your view is just more wrong than both of them put together. And because there's this constant iterative, almost like asymptotic approach to the truth. Now, of course, along the way, there's going to be a certain amount of mess. And I think scientists love that. Like they revel in this messiness. That's the reason you want to be a scientist. But as time goes by, assuming science as a discipline, as kind of an endeavor, is doing its thing properly, we will slowly but surely kind of asymptotically approach the truth. And that, I think, is super exciting. And I think that's the kind of idea and mode of thought that we need to spread beyond the realm of science.
There's this other point that Sam makes that I think is really important. It's this. Because science is always churning and always replacing old facts with better ones, sometimes pseudoscience and alternative medicine and mysticism and religion will shake their heads at that whole enterprise as if to say it's inconsistent and therefore it can't be trusted. Why live a life based on these sorts of facts, or base an institution or practice on them, if those facts might be overturned, if indeed we have a system for knowing about when they will be overturned?
There's this idea from the philosophy of science called the pessimistic meta-induction of science. I believe that's the term. Which the idea behind that is, we think we know we know the world and we understand it really well. And we have a really good handle on kind of theories to explain what's going on around us. But guess what? So did every previous generation. And it turns out they were wrong. And so there's kind of this like pessimistic meta-induction, this idea that like you can't really know if we're at sort of the end of knowledge because everyone previously to us has said the same thing and they've been wrong. On the other hand, though, and I think this is the most important point, is that, yeah, that might be true in terms of kind of the frameworks that we use to understand things. Just because it's important to have a certain amount of intellectual humility doesn't mean that we should conflate intellectual humility with a state of almost like willful ignorance. Like just because we might not necessarily be completely correct about the world and maybe we need to actually modify our theories and tweak things, that, I think, humility and skepticism and desire to kind of caveat things and be rigorous should not be confused with this idea that therefore, because things might not be completely true, therefore at any point everything might be totally wrong. And I think that's when we really get bogged down in that debate. And so I think, I mean, certainly we should be skeptical, and maybe our theories, and we should constantly be testing our theories. And frankly, I mean, the best way to really make your mark as a scientist is to actually overturn some really well-established idea. So it's not as if there is a lack of scientists trying to kind of refute things or be suitably skeptical. But at the same time, though, even though we should be skeptical, we should still recognize that the kind of the state-of-the-art ideas and models and theories should still be used. We shouldn't necessarily say that these things, even though they might be falsified, therefore should just be thrown out in advance of anything like that. And I think too often when people get into these debates, they kind of they wield the fact that science is a self-correcting enterprise, which is a good thing, as a reason for therefore throwing everything out. And I think that's the problem. An example would be like Newtonian physics versus Einsteinian physics. Like Newton was not completely accurate, but it doesn't mean you can't use that to calculate how a ball curves when you throw it or how a bridge works. I mean, it's great because those bridges are not going at like very close to the speed of light, and they're not massive as like stars. So really, like Newton is almost like kind of like a special case for Einsteinian physics. And I think that's the kind of thing where it's like this constant, and going back to the kind of this like asymptotic approach. And of course, I mean, there are paradigms and there are new frameworks of thinking, but these things are all usable kind of within their little, within whatever kind of framework makes sense for them. And going back to what I was saying before, intellectual humility should not be an excuse for willful ignorance. But we should always kind of try to query what we think is true, because chances are it might be outdated. So rather than trying to base our decisions, if we're scientists or not, on some kind of half-remembered fact from some magazine you read a decade ago, maybe look it up again. See if it's true. See if something's changed. And I think that kind of approach of saying that what we know and what we think to be true should be in draft form, and kind of essentially export that scientific mindset, this kind of constantly querying what we think is true and what we believe to be true. I think that is actually a very powerful way to kind of make sure we have the most up-to-date knowledge in terms of how we live our lives.
Keep up with Sam Arbesman over at arbesman.net. That's ARBESMAN.net. His Twitter handle is at Arbesman. And he's got a new book called Overcomplicated: Technology at the Limits of Comprehension. Hey, if you like these shows, you can support what we're doing here by going to patreon.com/youarenotsosmart. We're currently trying to reach a goal to hire a reporter for the show, and I know we can do it with your help. If you pitch in at any amount, you get the show with no advertisements. That's patreon.com/youarenotsosmart. That is it for this episode of the You're Not So Smart podcast. For links to everything that we talked about in this episode, you can go to youarenotsosmart.com. If you'd like to follow the show on Twitter, it is at NotSmartBlog. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter, I am at David McCraney. You can go to Facebook/YouAreNotSoSmart to join in on all of the conversations happening there about the show and stuff that happens around the show. This song you're listening to, that is by Banjopocalypse. The opening music is Clash by Caravan Palace. You can listen to the previous episodes of this show over at YouAreNotSoSmart.com or Stitcher or SoundCloud or iTunes or wherever you get podcasts. This is a rebroadcast, but we have new shows coming up after this. The replication of the marshmallow test and what happened when they tried to get a longitudinal study out of it. Why people who are politicians aren't great at talking about science, and all sorts of other stuff coming up soon.